Hi, I'm Norm Shealy. NormShealy.com. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight. This is Eva Herr, and tonight I have with us Dr. Mark Sieper, and we're going to talk about his book, Transcending the Speed of Light, Consciousness Quantum Mechanics. How are you, Mark?
Good. How are you?
Good. Thanks for being with us tonight. So before we get started, tell us a little bit about who you are and how you came to be where you are and do what you do, and where that people can find you if they want to get your book.
Okay. Well, I graduated college in 1970 and went on to the University of Chicago, where I got a master's degree in 1973-74. And at that time, I wrote my master's was on Freud's theory on the unconscious and then Carl Jung's theory, which goes into greater depth. And I just kept going into greater depth. And so I got into J.B. Ryan's work on ESP, telepathy. And one of the things I found, this was all the way back then, and I had a really good teacher, his name was Daniel G. Friedman, who allowed me to study ESP in my master's degree, was that J.B. Ryan had been studying telepathy with ESP cards since the 1930s. And here I was already in graduate school, and I had never even read about telepathy studies, and I'm finding that there's scientific studies in that. So I was already placed in an odd situation of knowing that scientists have studied these in statistical ways and found that humans indeed have telepathic abilities. It's pretty common once you start to look at it. At the same time, there was a giant prejudice in the academic community which was cutting all this out. So when I returned to Rhode Island, I started to teach courses in parapsychology at Providence College and also University of Rhode Island Extension. And then I went on to for my doctorate. My doctorate is on the inventor Nikola Tesla. And I worked with Stanley Krippner, who was he was my mentor, and he was very world famous for his work in dream telepathy. And so I wrote a paper for him on precognition, synchronicity, and the structure of time. And so those two articles or papers that I wrote, my master's thesis on beyond Freud and Jung into the realm of parapsychology, and my paper for Stanley Krippner, precognition, synchronicity, and the structure of time, was essentially the basis for this book, Transcending the Speed of Light. So that's, you know, a lot of my background in that regard.
You know, that's how I found you. I was talking to Stanley one day, and I said, Stanley, do you know anybody that might be good for my show? And he told me about it. He said, he's smart, Eva, be ready for him.
Oh.
So you must have impressed him. Okay, are you ready?
Yep.
Okay, I got a list of questions here. And I'm in litigation, so you don't know me, but I kind of do my shows like a deposition because it's all about fact-finding for me. First of all, what is your definition of consciousness so we can all be on the same page about what you're talking about?
Okay. What I do in this book and what I realized is that consciousness is a complex phenomenon. I think consciousness simply is awareness. But if it is awareness, if an electron repels another electron and is attracted to a proton, is that some form of primary awareness? As a kid, I used to play with magnets, I'm sure you have, where you get them to jump at each other, or you push one against the other, and it repels, and it jumps away. My argument is that awareness is built into the fundamental structure of matter. And when you build it up in a hierarchical sense, it gets more and more complex in the brain, and eventually you have what's called human consciousness. Mm-hmm. But human consciousness, from my point of view, is on a continuum, and it basically is simply a complex form of awareness, which is already present in the structure of matter.
So would it be correct to say that to you, consciousness would also be the ground of all being?
The ground of all being?
Mm-hmm. Because it sounds like it would be. I mean, some people think consciousness is just being awake. Either you're awake or you're not. But I think it's more than that, and it sounds like you think it's more than that, too.
Yes, because I think when a paramecium, if it moves towards sunlight or if a plant turns its leaves towards the sun, I think that's a form of consciousness. That's a form of awareness. And again, I think it just stems back to how electrons are constructed and protons are constructed. So, yes, I would agree with that.
Okay. Now that you bring up electrons and protons, I'm going to go down on into the middle of my questions and ask you a question about that. Do you, you say in your book that decision-making occurs at the level of the electron. What do you mean by that?
Well, as I said, if an electron is attracted to another, is attracted to a proton and repels an electron, that's a decision that's being made within the construction of the electron. I'm not saying that the electron itself is saying to itself, I'm choosing, but in a way it is, because why is it repelling one form of matter and being attracted to another form? In other words, consciousness permeates. This decision-making ability is fundamental to the structure of matter.
And so are you, does that also mean that you, the proton is just the carrier of the... I lack words sometimes to talk
information.
About information. Does it carry the energy to just simply carry, say, the light? Is that what it does?
Well, one idea is that the concept of information itself is actually more fundamental than matter. And in a sense, information, or some form of basic consciousness, in a sense, predates or is there before the matter, because the matter is imbued with this primary form of awareness.
Okay. All right, let's see. My next question is, what do you believe to be the source of intention, and what do you believe to be the source of creativity? That may be one question or two questions to you.
The source of intention and the source of creativity.
Mm-hmm.
This gets to the, you know, this gets to the theory of evolution. I discuss, you know, some of Gurdjieff's theories, which I think are very interesting, because he talks about evolution and also devolution. And so you have one of the you have energy moving up, and you also have energy coming from the top. He calls it, you know, help from above. I'll give you a couple examples of what I mean. For instance, I think all animals have a striving inside them, what Henry Bergson called the élan vital, a vital life force. So all of us are imbued with something in us which is propelling us outward, which is propelling us to express ourselves and to do something and make something of our life. But not just us, all animals, all plants. It's a life force within us. Darwin's theory of evolution is completely determined by the environment. The animals that are most adapted to the environment survive, and the ones that don't die out, and it's a random process. What the strict Darwinian theory is missing is the inner calling inside all these animals, which propels them out, which Gurdjieff is calling help from above. So when you look at it that way, creativity is very complicated. You know, I wrote another book on Tesla, and Tesla, this incredible inventor, said that he wasn't an inventor, he was a discoverer. And I'll give you one example of what I'm talking about, the invention of the airplane. Humans could have never invented the airplane if birds didn't fly. If the fact that there was something in nature which could already do this propelled us to try and emulate that. And so a lot of creativity, I think, in a way, is in a sense a form of self-discovery. It's in a way, it's a sense of opening up to already this creative force inside us, which we also see, in course, in dreams, which is an amazing window into this incredibly creative realm that's certainly inborn within all humans.
What was your PhD in?
It was in psychology.
But you got a lot of physics background too. Somewhere, where'd that come from?
Well, I worked with a physicist at Providence College. His name was Edwin Gorra. He's no longer on the planet. And Gorra was a very interesting man. His mentor was Werner Heisenberg. He was half Polish and half German, and he actually got his doctorate during World War II in Nazi Germany. And because he was half Polish, he was suspect by the Nazis. And Heisenberg, you know, protected him. Of course, he didn't know Heisenberg was involved with the atom bomb at that time. But he was brilliant. He was a genius. And I would spend a lot of time discussing many of these theories with him. And also, you know, I took physics in high school, and I took advanced mathematics in high school. I had very high board scores and my math scores and stuff. So, but I don't call myself a physicist. In no way, shape, or form do I consider myself a physicist. But I am very knowledgeable.
Yeah, it's great to pick the brain of a psychology person that knows about physics. Enjoy that. Okay, what I want, and again, I have a lot of trouble with linguistics because there's not words for everything sometimes, and even when there are, I don't always have that word in my vocabulary. How do you think that the information is conveyed from, and I'm going to use the word big mind because I don't know what else to call it, to the human brain?
From big mind?
Uh-huh.
You know, Lapsang Lampa has a great word. He calls it the oversoul, which is probably the same kind of thing. Esoteric Christianity, what really is the Christ? You know, I think all humans are extensions of the One. And I think that the highest states of consciousness are already inside us. So, it's a matter of self-discovery. God's inside everybody. And that gets to the whole idea of holographic paradigm, each is a reflection of the whole. So supermind, we're all a chunk of the giant. If we looked at it from a holographic point of view, we could say the whole universe is the giant hologram, and within that hologram is this great conscious force which people call God, or you could call it Mother Nature, or whatever the principle that started all this whole thing. And each of us is a little chip and a reflection of that giant supermind. So I would see it that way.
Mm-hmm. And I guess what I'm looking for is, do you believe that information is encoded into frequencies and patterns? And if you do, what do you mean, what is meant by the word frequency here?
Well, I think all thought is vibration, but I think matter, essentially, is all vibration. And when you really get to the structure of quarks and the elementary particles, it's all just vibratory states, in a sense, probably all vibratory states of light.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it all reduces down to photons, positive charges and negative charges. Everything is a manifestation of those, which essentially is all forms of vibration. So telepathy would be resonance. Being in tune with somebody implies that. Why is music so powerful? So I think it all reduces down to vibrations.
Okay. Let me go back to my question. Do you think there is some kind of charge behind, or an electron, or a proton, or a quark, something behind something that causes us to have negative emotions and something to have positive emotions, or do you think that's strictly a neurochemical of some sort? Does that make sense?
Well, I can look at it on different levels, because if you're just looking on the physics level, one of the things I get into in the book is a whole different view of how to combine ether, gravity, and electromagnetism, which I could talk about. But you were talking about a more global sense for humans, what's behind negative emotions and positive emotions. And I look at that in a number of different ways. I've read a lot of books on higher states of consciousness and theories on higher states from the 1800s. I have a collection of books from the turn of the century and before that. And one book discusses how in matter, opposites attract, but in mind, like attracts like. So confident people tend to hang around with confident people, and negative people tend to hang around with negative people. So that it's a, kind of an ironic situation. But I think that a lot of it has to do with our outlook, I think. You know, Tony Robbins gets into this, too. I mean, people that have negative thoughts are basically thinking about negative things, and people that have positive thoughts are thinking about positive things.
Talk to me about it, whatever it is that you were talking about from a viewpoint of physics.
From the physics point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had written Wizard, which is a biography on Tesla, and, you know, it's a very in-depth book, and I read every single thing you can imagine about Tesla. It took me like 14 years to put the book together. And people say, what else is there, you know, do you know about him? And I say, I don't know anything else. It's all in that book. Everything I know is in that book. And one of the things I came across was a statement, one sentence that he said to one person, Joseph Alsop, who was a very famous reporter in the New York Times. And you have to understand, I mean, 14 years of reading, you know, thousands of pages of writing by him and about him, hundreds of letters that he's written. The one sentence that he said that blew my mind was, that the sun was absorbing more energy than it was radiating. Now, when I first read that, I said, that's crazy because the sun's so hot, you know, it's radiating a tremendous amount of heat. But then I said to myself, well, Tesla is saying that the sun is radiating, is absorbing more energy than it's radiating, I've got to give that a lot of credence, and I've got to think about that. And in this transcending the speed of light, I finally, I think, figured out pretty much what he was getting to. He didn't know the term zero-point energy in those days, but he did know, of course, the idea of the ether. And basically, it comes down to this. Einstein was trying to combine the four known forces of the universe. So there's a strong nuclear force, which holds the nucleus together. There's the weak nuclear force, which holds the neutron together. And there's electromagnetism, which holds atoms together. The physicists have been able to combine all those three forces mathematically, but they've been unable to combine gravity with the other three forces, or for simplicity's sake, gravity with electromagnetism. Einstein literally spent the last 35, 40 years of his life working towards grand unification, trying to combine gravity with electromagnetism. And in studying Tesla's theories on ether and other theories on ether, I think it's actually a very simple way to explain the link between gravity and electromagnetism. And here basically is the theory, and I think you'll see it's pretty...
Before you get started, for people that don't know, remember, you're talking to an audience of people like me. A lot of them, they're interested, but we don't have the linguistics, and we don't know what we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean when you say ether?
Ether?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what happened in around 1905 or thereabouts, Einstein came up with his theory of relativity. And essentially what he was saying was that light could act like a wave or act like a particle. If it acted like a particle, it would travel to the Earth like a little bullet. So you've got these little bullets of light which would travel to the Earth. And if it acted like a particle, it didn't need a medium, the ether, to travel through. Meanwhile, you know, Michelson and Morley and a number of people tried to measure measure the ether or try to find the ether, and they couldn't find it and they couldn't measure it. So Einstein essentially said, there is no ether. You don't need an ether to explain how light could get from the Earth, from the Sun to the Earth, because it could travel like a particle. This meant that the ultimate structure of space was just empty space. There was nothing else but just empty space. That always struck me as nutty, because the ether has to be a medium for light to travel through. And eventually, Einstein in 1920 lectured on the ether at Leiden University. But if you read the first major biography about him by Clark in 1970, this lecture isn't even mentioned. And the entire 20th century essentially evolved with the idea or the notion that space was empty, that there's nothing in space between the sun and the earth or all the stars. It's just empty, and light travels like particles. Now, the reason why this is so dumb is many reasons. If you just look at a picture of a galaxy, you can see it's floating in something. I mean, it looks like it's, you can just see that it's floating in something, which is the ether. But I wrote a paper in 1979 or thereabouts. It's called The Universe is a Hologram. And I said that the ether is at least light itself. Because let's say, even if we agree that it started with the Big Bang, so let's say it starts with the Big Bang, and then everything expands out. So now we're at where we are right now, where the universe is 14 billion years old, and you have hundreds of billions of galaxies spread out all over the world. But as these galaxies are evolving, they're emitting light all of the time. So let's take today, where we are right now today. We're on the Earth, and the Earth is traveling around the sun on May 22nd or thereabouts. And if you took a Hubble telescope and you placed that Hubble telescope at any place in the universe, wouldn't you be able to see millions and billions of stars?
I would assume so. Is ether conscious?
Well, let me finish this idea first.
Okay.
So you take a telescope. We travel any place. Let's say if you travel to Jupiter and you're on a moon of Jupiter, you would see just about everything that you'd see here from a slightly different angle. From Pluto, slightly different angle. What I'm trying to say is every point in space contains the intersecting light from every star that ever existed. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes, it's logical.
It's self-evident. And I said in this paper, the ether is at least that. And it shows that every point in space codes for every other point in space, because every point in space contains the intersecting light from all of the stars. So when Einstein says there is no ether, that there, you know, it's empty space, to me it just seemed ridiculous because it's self-evident that that can't be so. So every point in space has to have incredible complex structure because it's got the light from every star in the universe at every point in space from the beginning of time. That's one level of the ether. But here's there's another level, which is what some people call the zero-point level. One of the things I was thinking about, electrons spin. Now, I had read a book called 30 Years That Shook Physics by George Gamow, G-A-M-O-W. When I was a kid, I read another book by him, 1, 2, 3, Infinity. Gamow is one of the founding fathers of quantum physics. If you read about the history of quantum physics, you read about Heisenberg, Bohr, Einstein, Gamow. I mean, he's just one of these, the top 20 or the top 30 major physicists of that time period. In the book, he writes that electrons, when Goudsmit and Uhlenberg measured the electron spin, he found that they spun at 1.37 times the speed of light. This was discovered in the 1920s, and it's in a major important book. Now, this is all very important because it violates the theory of relativity. Einstein says that nothing could travel faster than the speed of light, right?
Mm-hmm.
You with me?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm listening.
Okay. So nothing can travel faster than the speed of light. But Goudsmit and Uhlenbeck measured the electron spin and found that it's fast, that it's spinning faster than the speed of light. This created a huge problem. So Paul Adrian Dirac came along, and he said, let's, instead of calling it 1.37 times the speed of light, let's call it the square root of negative 1, which is an imaginary number because there's no such thing as a square root of a negative number. A negative times a negative is a positive. So the letter I is the square root of negative 1. So he said, let's call the electron spin the square root of negative 1. By doing that, he was able to combine Einstein's theory of relativity with what was called quantum physics. What Gamow says is that if it spun faster than the speed of light, it wasn't violating anything in quantum physics. What it was violating was Einstein's theory. But Einstein was a demigod. And if Einstein said nothing could travel faster than the speed of light, they needed to come up with a way to come up with a new theory which would combine these two forces and not interfere with Einstein's theory. What I'm trying to say is Einstein's wrong. Obviously, electrons are spinning at 1.37 times the speed of light. But by changing it to an imaginary number, Dirac got a Nobel Prize and he combined quantum physics with Einstein's theory of relativity. So here's what I think. If electrons are spinning at 1.37 times the speed of light, they're traveling faster than the speed of light. That's what the ether is. They are absorbing ether all of the time at a rate more rapid than the speed of light. Now, that's what causes the electrons to spin. And that spin is then converted into electromagnetic energy. So when Tesla said that the sun was absorbing more energy than it was radiating, what he was talking about is the etheric view of gravity. So I think I can explain it all. I think it'll make all, total sense to you. The Earth has what's called gravity. So you jump up and you fall back down because you're attracted to the Earth because gravitational attraction is pulling you back down. That's not what gravity is according to this theory. What this theory is that all matter is absorbing ether all the time at 1.37 times the speed of light, causing all the matter to spin. So the reason that we fall back down to the Earth when we jump up is because there's a giant influx of energy all of the time. The planet is absorbing light energy, etheric energy, all of the time. All of the particles, all the mass in the universe, I mean in planets and stars, is being absorbed ether all of the time. So when Einstein said space was curved around stars, what's really happening is like it senses a sinkhole. And so when light is bent towards stars, it's not bent towards stars because space is curved. It's bent towards stars because the stars are absorbing this primary energy, zero-point energy, or the etheric energy, all the time. That energy is then converted into electromagnetism, and that's how you can combine gravity with electromagnetism, which was Einstein's dream of grand unification. The reason why he didn't come up with it was he had to abandon his theory of relativity, which he was unwilling to do. So that's what I think. So I think that to get back to your ultimate question about the structure of space and stuff, there is an underlying energy which we can't see, but we are absorbing. Your body's absorbing it. My body's absorbing it. The room, the table in your room is absorbing it. All matter is absorbing this ether, this primary substance, all the time, and converting it into what we're calling electromagnetism.
That's very interesting. It makes a lot of sense. I mean, I have to really focus to understand you because it's very above my head, but it sure does make a lot of sense. What does that mean to the everyday person as to who we are?
I think it means a lot of things. I think it means that we interface different dimensions, because I think Einstein was right in the sense that the speed of light is certainly a limiting dimension. One of the things I argue in the book is that our mind is probably living in a tachyonic dimension, and a dimension faster than the speed of light. You know that, according to his theory, time slows down when you reach the speed of light, and if you could actually reach the speed of light, time would stop. But for you and me, time doesn't have any meaning, really. I mean, you and I spoke a couple of months ago, and you said, you know, would you like to be on the show, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, our mind transcends time all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas our physical body is bound by this physical world, but our mind is interacting with this tachyonic realm, which on another level, it was the level I was talking about from the physics point of view, it's being converted into physical matter. But our mind is probably living in this other realm. So I think that that's part of what it means to the everyday person, that our mind transcends time, that it lives in a realm, in a sense, beyond the speed of light. It's just in another dimension.
It's as good a theory as I've heard. It's very, very interesting to think about that, and it makes a lot of sense. Now, when you brought up another dimension, that's one of my questions. Do you believe existence to be multidimensional? And if so, you also quote Michio Kaku in your book. If you do think that, how many dimensions do you think there exist, and why do you believe there's that number?
Well, I'm dealing with a very simple model. Einstein's got four dimensions: three dimensions for space, and one dimension for time. Uspensky has three dimensions for time, so it'll be, you know, he's equal rights, three and three. So you've got three for space. The first dimension of time would be this moment right now. The second dimension essentially would be the future, probable futures. And the third dimension would be maybe the mind of God, you know, all and everything. But I'm just arguing for right now for a five-dimensional universe. In other words, I'm saying let's just totally agree with Einstein. We live in a four-dimensional world, but we have a mind. It has to have its own realm, and I'm calling that inner space. So I'm arguing that there's five dimensions. One dimension for inner space. Now, that inner space, I think, is multidimensional. For instance, you have dream life, the Akashic mm-hmm. records, contact with the spirit world, UFOs, all of that stuff. So inside inner space, that is multidimensional. But I'm just trying to get mainstream scientists to at least consider that the mind has its own space. Let's call it inner space, or what Rudolf Steiner called counter space. It's like the opposite. You know, you can go outward into infinity, mm-hmm. or you could go inward into infinity. So it's kind of like on the internet,
right,
where we have a hyperlink. Every point in inner space opens up to a new infinity.
Another question that I have: do you think that magnetic monopoles, that energy, have you read Tiller's work?
Yes, I'm not real familiar with the magnetic monopoles. I have read about it, but not enough to talk about it.
I'm not real familiar either. I just know that it exists, but it makes me wonder if that's why what goes around comes around. You know, it sends and receives rather both ways in this, and whatever this is.
What it does trigger in my mind is some of the things that Tom Bearden has talked about, and that is, what really is connecting the Earth with the Sun? There might be some primary hyperspatial link between, you know, the Earth and the Sun, or let's say the Sun and all the planets in there. That it might be linked to this idea of the monopole, but it's not just what we're calling gravity. That there's some other primary instantaneous link between the planets, maybe between all the stars too.
That That was another one of my questions, because Tom's a friend of mine, too. He's a great guy. I love his work. I know he's controversial, but I think he's great. What do you believe, or do you believe there's a connection of scalar waves to consciousness?
Yes, I think that they are. I think that our mind is in inner space. Our brain can translate it down to the physical world. So let's say you have a thought, I want to pick up a pen and write a letter. The thought exists in inner space. It has to step down to the physical world through the brain to come out to the physical world, and you write the letter. But the whole idea of scalar waves, non-directional primary energy, the resonance model, I think, is a very good model to explain telepathy. A lot of telepathy between twins. There's a primary link that you have with your family members, with people that are on the same wavelength. I think, ancient man was more tapped into this idea, too, of you can call it scalar waves, but in a way it's just ESP, too. It's just some primary link between people.
I wonder if that's not the magnetic monopoles, too. I think about that all the time. Let's go back to your ether for a minute. That would make some kind of logical sense as to how we would maintain some kind of individuality. What do you think contains the individual vibratory rate of individuals that, I'm going to use human because I'm more thinking about the gradients of consciousness. What makes one person more conscious, and when I use that word, I mean aware of who you are, basically. What makes one person more conscious than the other? Is it contained in the aura? And if it is, what contains the aura to this particular person? Or what holds our individual vibratory rate? Does that make any sense?
Yes. There's a lot to that. I mean, I think all our chips off the one. I like the idea of the mandala. Let's say God or the great I am is in the center, and we're all spokes on the wheel. But we all have our own individuality. I mean, every snowflake is different. And that's a mind blower. Every snowflake is different.
From a physics perspective, how could we all be so different, the conscious part of us?
From a physics point of view?
If you look at the consciousness level, and I'm using that word, have you read David Hawkins' work?
Yeah.
You know how he talks about the gradients of consciousness? What in a human being, it's certainly not the brain, it can't be that. It's got to be something more. What makes us have individuality, holds our field together? What is that?
Well, I think you can look at it a lot of ways. Again, I like Gurdjieff's idea of the waking. He's got four states of consciousness, sleep, waking, and then objective consciousness. And he said basically sleep is regular sleep, waking sleep is robotic existence that we're all kind of trapped into. And then there's another state above that, which is the waking state. Now, how do you know the waking state really even exists? And he says the way you know it is every once in a while you wake up, you say, my God, I've been asleep. And I think that happened a lot. Look what happened with the crash of the stock market a couple of weeks ago. Everyone realized, my God, what the heck were we doing? We were allowing these banks to loan out money at these ridiculous rates, 30 to 1. And so you wake up because you've been asleep. And that's for all of us. So I think we all have a responsibility to try and wake up. So there's one way to do it is to look around you and not follow the crowd. But I think another way is self-exploration. And I do think that trying to bring consciousness into your dream life, keeping a dream diary, really getting in touch with this primary consciousness. Carl Jung said something very amazing, and it's funny and it's ridiculous, but it's amazing. It's in an interview that I saw him, and you see him live in the interview, and he says, the unconscious really is unconscious, and he cracks up, he just laughs, and it's funny, but we all have something in us called our unconscious that really is unconscious in the sense that we are not aware of this incredibly powerful conscious force inside us. We get little glimmers of it. And the highly creative people, the Picassos and Salvador Dali's and Steven Spielberg's and stuff, those kind of people who do creative things are tapped in a little bit more than the average everyday person. But most of those people, I think, are tapped in, particularly Salvador Dali comes to mind, by trying to draw on their dream life because they know that this tremendously creative force is inside them, and they're trying to read it. It's a primary form of awareness that's hundreds of thousands, probably millions of years old, that is inside all of us, that is linked to how life started, how life began, and has tremendous intelligence in there. So I would say that's one of the keys, is to really tap into your dream life and really begin to have a dialogue with your own unconscious, with this realm inside yourself.
All right, we've got about 15 minutes. So I've got a couple of questions. Then if we have any time left, I want you to talk about whatever you want to talk about that we haven't talked about.
Okay.
Okay. I believe in something that I call non-duality, and I believe the non-dual state to be the bottom of everything, the thing that the ether sits on, whatever that is. I don't know what to call that. So here's my question. Do you think that possibly the zero point field could be the divider for duality, the thing that takes things from just the pure point of energy until the things that divide up and start making reality as we know it, the hologram? Does that make sense?
Yes. I think we know so little about that realm. I do think that I explore it a bit in my book, but there's a lot of other people who've written and know a lot more about the zero point realm from a physics point of view.
There's something below that field, too, you know. I don't know what that is, but something's there, some energy or something. But something happens at that point, I think.
I look at it from two points of view. One is this physics point of view, the zero-point energy. The other is the esoteric aspect of the Bible. You know, the name of God is I Am, or I Am that I Am.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's the I Am inside us. It's tapping into your I-ness, you know, and that links you to this higher consciousness, which we can call, you know, God or whatever. And I think that they're linked. I think the zero-point realm and the ultimate I Am inside each of us is linked in what I'm calling inner space or hyperspace. So, but one of the big problems problem is a good word, is how to reconcile the physical primary space, what's called the zero-point energy, and the mental hyperspace. What's the link between those two? And so I'm more knowing of the mental realm. I've really studied a tremendous amount on, you know, the structure of the unconscious and all the levels to that. But I think there's got to be a way to reconcile those two, and I attempt to do it. But I think that's still a big problem, to try and reconcile those two primary realms.
Okay, my next question is, we talked a little bit earlier about neurochemical balances, and I know you talk in your book about where you think the sense of I is contained. And then I'll talk about another question, how do you think big mind filtrates the brain? But you stated it, how do you believe the psyche infuses itself into the brain? That's such a great statement. Do you think God has emotion? I mean, there are not serotonin and dopamine and norepinephrine floating around in the universe. So how do you think the psyche comes into the body, and where do you think it sits, and how do you think it conveys whatever it has to say to who we are?
It's a complex question.
No,
I think part of it, again, is this Elan Patel, this vital life force inside all of us, which is propelling us to express ourselves creatively. And it's just tapping. I think most people know they have a talent. Some people are talented in music. Some people in art. Some people, you know, just all different kind of math, English, linguistics. So I think people recognize it on that level. But just from a kind of a physics point of view, it's real complicated. I think on just one level, I think the human brain is able to construct the electrons and protons in a hierarchical sense to come up with not only awareness, but what we have that the other animals don't have is self-awareness. We're aware that we're aware. That puts us in another realm. But I see it in a hierarchical sense.
Do you think reptation plays a role in the hierarchy?
Do I think what plays
rotation. The rotation?
Spin or?
Yeah.
Yeah, I do. In fact, one of the things, you know, Tesla discovered the rotating magnetic field. He was able to harness electricity which was alternating current to make a motor spin, which is a big deal to change it from direct current to just harness alternating current as it was. It was alternating its direction. And I discuss this idea of the rotating magnetic field as maybe how the Big Bang essentially started. In other words, if you had two energies, yin and yang, out of phase with each other, and you did it along the lines of Tesla's rotating magnetic field, that would be the primary trigger which would start this whole thing. But I think I don't think you can escape, and one of the greatest mysteries, the more you look at it, you realize that there's a conscious force, intentionality, which is the word you use, behind it all. And I mean, it comes to mind, you know, that even, you know, Barack Obama talks about it in one of his books. What came before our universe? You know, what's before this universe? I mean, it's vastly mysterious, but I think that ultimately we're a product of some type of conscious, intentional force. And I think that's that psyche, which is embedding itself in humans, but it's also in all, you know, and our pets and our and the animals and the world around us.
All right, we've got about 10 minutes. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I'd like to talk about a few things. One of the things I'd like to talk about, I'm a product of, you know, the late 60s, 70s, around that time. That's when I graduated college. I thought that parapsychology would be the thing. I was teaching parapsychology. I thought departments would open up. The Russians, of course, were doing psychic research, and there was that famous book, Psychic Discoveries Behind the Iron Curtain, and we were getting real interested in it, and then it kind of disappeared, and we became a lot more conservative, and nobody's allowed to talk about telepathy and parapsychology in the academic world. It's now all hidden in the consciousness studies program, and it's a mystery to me. I mean, I think, you know, J.B. Ryan established that humans had telepathic ability in the 1930s, and I'm a scientist. I see myself as a scientist, and I really, my jaw drops when I think about it. I don't understand why.
It seems to need
Americans
control.
Have,
I hate to say it, but that's what it seems to control. You know, people, they can control you if you're ignorant, but once you realize that you have certain capabilities, that control is gone.
But we study so many things. We study cancer. We study.
Yeah, but we study it from the wrong perspective. You know, pharmaceuticals is not going to cure cancer. But, you know, there are fabulous cancer cures out there, but nobody
mm-hmm.
tells anybody.
Yeah, I
or
do
you get
talk
put in jail
it,
if you do.
I talk about it in the book, you know, Royal Rice and his studies. So what I'm trying to say is, on a few levels, I'm making a plea to the young people that are listening to this show, is to study telepathy. Just study, you know, do dream telepathy studies. We should be, as a society, we should be studying human higher abilities and not see it as some type of threat. Just see it as a window into the greater human potential. That's one of the things I try to deal with in the book. The other thing I'm trying to deal with, really, is that we need to redefine what we mean by the fundamental structure of matter. You have to question things. You have to even question Einstein's theory. I do not think that this huge super collider that they built in Bern, Switzerland, is going to find the God particle because they're not looking at something traveling faster than the speed of light. They're smashing two things into each other to try and find these things when, in fact, it's more primary than that. So that all gets back to Gurdjieff's idea of waking up. I think that that's one of the things, you know, I try to teach kids in my class, Gurdjieff's theories, is to simply question what's around you and become, you know, more aware. I also, again, make a plea for people to keep a dream diary, to get in touch with their creative self. In my class, I have kids draw their dreams, and they have to do it in color, and if they don't, I hand it back. They got to do it in color. And I also, you know, I've written a book on Tesla, and I think that, to me, Tesla is important because he invented or discovered what became the hydroelectric power system. That's another thing which bugs me. They keep trying to tell us, you know, let's go nuclear. And meanwhile, hydroelectric power is clean energy. It won't hurt the environment. We should be doubling the size of Niagara Falls, doubling the size of all the hydroelectric plants if we really need more power. So that's part of what I'm trying to say, is that people should simply wake up, not accept. My mother has a saying, you know, just because it's in a book doesn't make it true. You know, there's so many people just accept the status quo and don't question it. And really, it's an exciting realm. You know, what we've talked before, and your show, you know all these tremendously interesting people, which open up our minds to these greater possibilities.
You're absolutely right. You know, we didn't even get to touch on something that I meant to at the very beginning, and that was will, free will, and synchronicity. We've got about 8 minutes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Do you think we have free will? Well, first of all, what is will? And do you think we have complete free will? If we had free will, why would anything bad happen? Why would we ever be late for an appointment? Why would we get lost? Why would we forget? And then do you believe synchronicities indicate some occurrence? And what do you believe to be their importance? And that's the last I'm going to ask you, promise.
Well, there's a big question about free will. I have a section in the book on astrology. I do think that people have certain talents along certain lines. I think we are a product of the structure of the planetary alignment and all that. I think it plays a role. And I'm an Aquarian, but, you know, if you look at my chart, Jupiter plays a big role in my chart. And so I study the idea of what Jupiter stands for. It stands for expansion. And so I'm interested in that. But ultimately, I do think we have free will. But it also gets to this whole idea of God. You know, a lot of people, particularly people that were victims of the Holocaust, I no longer believe in God. I just saw a comedian on last night, total atheist. I've never understood the atheistic point of view, simply because I cannot believe I'm the smartest thing in the universe. There's got to be something smarter than me out there. Me meaning humans, and I think humans are awfully intelligent, but we're nowhere near. We can't possibly be the most intelligent thing.
Well, what is free will?
Well, what I'm trying to say is, if there is a God, and I believe there is a God, and essentially, he's given us free will, but if we're stupid enough to let the Taliban take over or let the idiots get a hold of nuclear bombs, then it would be the end of society. There's no great hand going to come down and stop it all. My wife's mother had a saying, you know, God helps those who help themselves. And I think that's pretty much it. One way or another, we're left to do whatever we want. You have the ability, if you want, to shoot your neighbor. I mean, you can do that.
Here's something I wanted you to think about. I ask everybody this question. You're driving down the road in a car as a three-year-old, and you're strapped in the car seat in the back seat that has a little yellow steering wheel, and God's driving the car. You think your steering wheel's driving that car till you get down the street to the stop sign, and the playground's on the right and the grocery store is on the left. You're going to the playground, you think. Well, the car goes left and you go to the grocery store, so you really don't have free will. Somebody else is driving. Something's driving. Or you would go right to the playground. Otherwise, you just throw a big fit and at that moment realize you're not driving that car.
Well, I think we have free will within certain guidelines. In other words, I think karma holds. I mean, if you lead a good life, you're much more likely to have good things happen to you. And if you lead a bad life, look at John Edwards, you know. I mean, whatever happens to him is a product of his decisions. But he made decisions, which leads him to where he is right now. So I think we have a tremendous amount of free will in the decisions that we make. But I love basketball. I can't dunk the ball. I can barely touch the backboard if I'm lucky. I mean, so, you know, we're linked by our physical ability, too. That plays a role. So, yeah, I know what you're saying, but I think we have a lot of freedom. But you have to be careful in walking that line, because we can't do everything we want, because there are repercussions involved. So in that sense, we don't have free will.
Okay. I just wonder, I guess what I wonder is, if we do live in a hologram, are we living a movie and it's already set out? If we're, you know, did somebody put that maybe there for us to learn to experience the things that we have to experience in order so, then we wouldn't have a choice, really. I mean, you have a choice.
We're free within guidelines, but
okay.
But I think we are being, I think we're being driven or compelled to try and save this planet, you know, to stop global warming and
yeah.
all that. I mean, there's an impetus inside us that we feel responsible to try and help this planet evolve in a normal, good fashion. And to that extent, we are being guided or moved along a certain line.
All right, you've got 2 minutes. Why don't you tell everybody where to find you again and the name of your book, if you have more than one. I just know about this one.
Yes,
where to find you.
I've written a number of books. This book is, you know, Transcending the Speed of Light. My biggest book I've written is Wizard, The Life and Times of Nikola Tesla. It's, you know, something like 60,000 copies in print, and it's really 14 years of my life went into that book.
I could spend a whole hour asking you about him. I think it's great.
And I've also written another book on graphology. I'm a handwriting expert, 35 years experience as a graphologist. It's called The Definitive Book of Handwriting Analysis, and that literally has 35 years of my research. It's a 300-page book, but it's got a tremendous amount of information. And all of it can be found, you know, on my website, which is my name, markcipher.com.
Okay, spell it so everybody will know.
MARCSEIFER.com.
And your contact information's on there if anybody wants to ask you a question?
Yes, I get emails all the time, and I'm happy to answer people.
Great. Thank you so much, Mark, for coming on.
Thank you. This was a wonderful experience for me, Eva.
Thank you. And I hope you'll come back sometime so I can talk to you and ask you questions for hours.
Well, I love the way you ask the questions. It was great.
Thank you. Good night, Mark.
Good night.
Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X-Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. Your host, Brooks Agnew, believes everything we do will eventually affect the universe. He's trying to do that on purpose each Sunday from 6 to 9 p.m. Eastern Time, right here on the BBS Radio Network. Come where the results are always positive. Explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You'll be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch. X Squared Radio.
Hey everybody, this is Dean Hinsenbrink. I am the star of science fiction show Lex the Dark Zone. Well, I hope you're listening to Dr. Fred Bell's show on bbsradio.com. See, well, if you want to do Dr. Fred Bell's Health, Science, and Energy...
Health Science and...
Well, what was it?
Health Science and...
Health Science...
Just say you're listening to Dr. Bell's Health Science and...
And Energy...
Health Science and...
Energy Show?
That
yeah.
works. In fact, I can
Health, Energy, and Science Show.
Health Science and...
We just call it the Dr. Bell Show.
Okay, well, that's what I did.
Same thing, only a little shorter. Yeah, same thing. Health Science and...